The original Planet Earth TV series was produced in 2006, and at the time it was the most expensive nature documentary ever commissioned by the BBC. It quickly became one of the most beloved and most watched nature series of all time. Now, a little over a decade later, the BBC has produced a sequel, Planet Earth 2. It'll be airing tomorrow in a three-network simulcast across Sundance TV, AMC, and BBC America at 9 p.m. And I'm very pleased that it brings Mike Gunton, the executive producer of Planet Earth 2, to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Very nice to be here.
Now, that the last was such a success, why did you decide to make a sequel to the series? Did you feel you'd left stuff out, or has the world changed so much since?
A bit of both of those. It was quite daunting, to be honest. As you say, you know, the first Planet Earth was such a massive success. The shadow it cast was pretty long, but we felt that there was a real justification for three reasons, really. The first was lots of news stories. You know, the scientific community were generating all these news stories, partly actually stimulated by the original Planet Earth. Secondly, the technology. And a lot of what we do is driven by new technology. And this doesn't happen in a sort of gradual evolution. It comes in bursts. And there was a big burst for the first one. And then we felt that there had been this breakthrough in a number of different ways of technology, which meant actually we could revisit the planet and take a different perspective, which was really critical.
When you were looking at similar things like snow leopards.
Yeah, I mean, snow leopard was interesting because, of course, there are some phenomenal stories in the original Planet Earth. And we looked at them and said, you know, kind of had a list. Should we go back to some of those because they were part of Planet Earth and we should revisit? Or should we definitely not go back because we did them in Planet Earth 1? Snow Leopard fell into the first category. We thought, actually, yes, we did do a little bit on that, but we really only scratched the surface. And this new technology, this new approach, which was to get much closer to the animals, meant snow leopards could be done again in a different way.
And how do you get much closer to the animals? Because some of these things seem miraculous. It seems almost impossible. I felt in some cases you must have mounted cameras on animals so that we could see the way they moved.
Well, with one exception, which we did on for one story with a golden eagle, we didn't put any cameras on animals, partly because you can't. I mean, wild animals, these are wild animals. You cannot ethically or even for any reason, you can't do that. However, I mean, it's good you felt that because the drive for us was to say Planet Earth 1, the perspective was almost a God's eye view of the world. This stand back, observe, be awe-inspired about the planet. But we felt actually we could take a different perspective, which was to switch and say, right, let's take the cameras down, put them in the world of the animals, get as close as we can, see the world through their eyes, see the challenges they face through their eyes, so you get a sense of what's at stake for them. And that's only possible by miniaturization of cameras.
And what's at stake in some cases is some of them are faced with extinction. You may very well have captured certain animals in situations that we may never see them in again.
Well, that, in fact, was the third reason why we felt it was time to do this again. Because there was a sense of a groundswell building about people's sense of the consciousness of the fragility of the planet. And we felt, actually, yes, it's time to readdress that. And Planet Earth 2 does, in every episode, make some reference. It was impossible not to make some reference to some of the challenges beyond the ones that Mother Nature puts in front of these animals, some of the ones that humanity puts in front of these animals, and make sure that we balance the wonder with the fragility.
And in some cases, the animals live in and outside of cities, which wasn't always the case in the past, because we keep on encroaching on their territory.
Absolutely. Again, we felt that as part of that sense of not being able to ignore the hand of man, if you like, there is also a story to be told about a new habitat, which we've never done before, really, which is the one, as you say, which is dominated by humanity. But if you could look at that that world, that urban world, in the same way as you do a jungle or a mountain or a desert, and use the same technology and the same visual approach and make a beautiful, thought-provoking, dramatic film, then actually it's a quite legitimate way to talk about this, a whole new ecosystem.
Are cities hospitable to animals? Hyenas live in and outside of Harare,
yeah,
and in Ethiopia. And they seem to be fighting with some small cats over scraps of meat.
The interesting thing is that the concreting over of the natural world by cities, of course, is basically not good for natural for wildlife. But there are some creatures, and often they have some strange pre-adaptations which allow them to thrive in cities. Because actually, cities are quite good places if you can survive there, because lots of resources, lots of food. And you mentioned those hyenas. That's a very, very unusual situation. There's a historical relationship between the people of that town and hyenas. And the hyenas kind of switch their behavior in a way that's quite extraordinary.
Well, even people who live in the exurbs here in the United States have to contend with deer, with bears, with sometimes wild cats, because we've actually started living in their territory, although we see them as invading our territory.
No, absolutely right. I mean, there are definitely different classes of relationship. You know, things like peregrine falcons in New York, famous for peregrine falcons, they do incredibly well here because it's effectively New York mimics the habitat they live in. But creatures like leopards in Mumbai, which is one of our stories in the show, that's exactly like your mountain lions. Mumbai has effectively overlapped there, and they've just never left. And now the highest density of leopards in the world actually is in Mumbai.
In the city.
In the city.
Each episode in the series focuses on a particular geographic location. Have they changed over the years? Did you pretty much go back to what you had done 10 years ago?
Some places. I think the object of the exercise really was to try and audiences want to see new things, fundamentally. They want to be taken to new places they haven't seen before. So I think underpinning our efforts were, let's not revisit places, let's go to new places. So we tended to not do a compare and contrast how things had changed. I think there is a very interesting show to be done about that, but that's not really what we've done in this particular episode.
Well, climate change, I'm sure, was in the back of your minds, and things have changed over the last 10 years.
There's no question. You know, often on route to some of the locations that we go to, you know, you do pass through places you went to. I've been doing this nearly 30 years, and Attenborough's been 60 years. You know, you go through these places and you think, oh, no, it was not like this 15, 20 years ago. And often, to be honest, climate change is probably not something you notice quite so obviously, but habitat change in terms of planting, you know, oil palm or deforestation, that's much more overt, much more obvious thing to notice.
And you filmed in some very remote islands. How vulnerable are they to climate change?
Well, every habitat is vulnerable to the whole gamut of these issues, everything from climate change to deforestation to where. But I think islands, funnily enough, of course, are susceptible to those. But what we felt was more pertinent, actually, was they're very susceptible to invasive species. Mm-hmm. And we featured a story in the island show of these invasive ants, which you'd think to yourself wouldn't do any harm. There are any ants. But without any predators, they just run amok on this island. And islands are so... ecosystems have a sort of inbuilt kind of self-healing. The bigger they are, the more complex they are. And island ecosystems are often quite simple, quite small in terms of the range. So they're much more easily upset by something like these invasive ants, which basically have messed the whole thing up.
I'm speaking with Mike Gunton, who's a creative director at the BBC and executive producer of Planet Earth 2, which airs tomorrow night at 9 on a 3 network simulcast across Sundance TV, AMC, and BBC America. There are some things I wondered, well, why didn't you have the Komodo dragons in the first series? They're so fascinating. And now we have an opportunity to see them.
They are remarkable creatures. You almost can't believe that something that feels like it's a legacy from the Jurassic or something is still lumbering around in these remote islands. And I mean, that's one of the things about going to remote places. You do discover things that you've not seen before.
But then you also just seem to be there at the right moment. For example, there's a segment of the marine iguana hatchlings trying to evade the snakes, which is just terrifying. Did you just have to hang around a lot? Or did you know that at 3:30 on March 12th, this sort of thing happens every year.
I wish we did know that at 3:30 on March 12th, things would make our lives a lot easier. No, that's a very unusual story, that, because Liz, who was the director of that sequence, we went there we knew we were going there. You know, we do a lot of planning. We don't just go places and see what happens. We have very specific stories we want to follow.
And then you have to bring the right things. For example, you mentioned the technology. Yeah. You have to know whether you're going to employ drones or paragliders, yeah, or if you're just going to put remote cameras in place.
Yes. I mean, that story of the iguanas is a good example of that as well, because we went there knowing we were going to film baby iguanas, well, marine iguanas, and also baby iguanas. We knew that they, when they hatched out, they were sometimes hunted by things like hawks and maybe the odd snake. We had no idea at all that these snakes would aggregate, gather, and wait in ambush for these. And so when it happened, all the other things we were going to film, forgotten, concentrate on that. We had two cameras there and this new technology, which is these little tiny stabilized cameras, which means they're like little steady cams that they use in the movies, which means you can run along beside the creatures. And because we had two, we could get both the snake and the iguana perspective. So you get almost a kind of movie-like story of both you know, antagonists in the drama.
A friend said it was kind of like a Wes Craven movie.
Yes. No, I mean, it's very interesting. People, I almost defy anybody to watch that sequence without shouting at the television, "Run, little iguana, run!"
I'm happy that you were able to get David Attenborough again to narrate the series. It just wouldn't have felt the same without him. How old is he now?
Well, he was 90 last year. I was involved in a couple of shows for his 90th, celebrating his 90th birthday, and I took him up in that balloon right at the beginning of the whole series that starts the whole thing off about 3 weeks before he was 90. Mm. So no, he's you couldn't do it without him. He is the voice and the authority, and he is kind of what defines the series in many ways.
Do you write the script after the film has been edited together?
A bit of both. You definitely write a running order and a script, and you have very clear ideas about what you want to say broadly. But of course, the detailed script only comes out after you've actually got the nuances of what actually happens, because animals don't read scripts. You can write as many scripts as you like. They won't read them when you turn up on the occasion.
And then you don't know where they're going to go. You follow these animals to all sorts of places that you couldn't have predicted they were going, or you couldn't have predicted whether there was suddenly going to be an avalanche.
Yep, and that's part of the nervousness of doing this job, but part of the excitement, because often, you know, it's a bit of a common phrase, but you know, the truth is stranger than fiction. You could write these things into a script, and Mother Nature would always trump you.
How many people involved in this project worked on the first one?
Not that many. I think probably about four or five. And nobody worked in a very senior position on that series. So it was quite nice to bring a fresh team to this and with fresh perspectives, because it was a different perspective.
You had to obviously have done a lot of research in advance. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gone to the island of Zebedovsky in Antarctica.
Yes.
If you didn't know something interesting was happening there.
That's one of my favorite stories, because that is a crazy expedition. I mean, that took a year to plan because
it's so inaccessible.
Oh yeah, it's I don't know how many people have set foot in it. Probably a handful of people in history, and to get there is almost the only way we could find to get there is you have to go there by sailboat. And there was one person who had the experience and knowledge to do that, and he'd just retired. So we had to persuade him out of retirement to take us there. And, you know, once you're on that island, it's Robinson Crusoe. There's no medical support. There's no, if anything goes wrong, you're completely on your own.
And the penguins are okay with strangers coming for the first time?
That's one of the joys of, I mean, penguins anyway are creatures that don't seem to mind human beings very much. And secondly, because nobody it's a bit like the Galapagos, famous for the fact that animals aren't afraid of people because they don't really know what they are. So 1.5 million penguins, they were kind of more inquisitive about what the team were doing there. You know, come and visit them and say, hey, hi.
At one point, a wave comes and douses one of your cameras.
Well, that happens all the time, I'm afraid. But in fact, I think we really wanted to try and get the camera in that position to get that sense of... Because when you'll see the sequence, one of the dramas of that story is not only this island is basically a volcano that sticks out of the ocean. It's a smoking volcano with sheer cliffs. To get into the water, the poor little penguins have to kind of throw themselves into the surf. But that's even harder when they get back. How do they get out of the surf? And they get thrashed against the rocks and all that. And they're amazingly resilient. So we wanted to get a camera into position to get a sense of what it's like to suddenly be engulfed in one of these enormous waves.
I used to know somebody who was snake phobic, and if a snake ever came on the TV, she would freak.
Mm-hmm. Don't watch
your
series.
Warning labels.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people have said snakes scare them, but I think. You don't want to. The thing about that sequence is I would hate to demonize snakes. Those snakes are just doing what they need to do. They're starving. That's why they all go crazy after that, trying to catch that iguana. That's probably the only food they're going to get for months. So I think you have to be. Have to remember that there's no goodies or baddies really in the natural world. Everyone's trying to do the best they can.
Do you feel that some of the animals that you have captured in the wild won't be around if you decide to do a Planet Earth 3 10 years from now?
I mean, that's always a risk. You kind of hope that by showing people these creatures in Planet Earth 2, that people will be sort of encouraged to be more caring and more thoughtful and maybe more more willing to protect them or do something about protecting them. So I hope not, but you do worry. There's no doubt.
Some of the most magical scenes are of birds flying.
Mm.
You capture birds of paradise in Papua from the air for the first time. A female's point of view.
Yes.
Is that done with drones?
No, actually, that's actually interesting. That's on the ground. That's a really good example of how taking a different approach is not only fantastic television, but utterly revelatory. Because the story that this is a creature called a Wilson's bird of paradise. It's a very bizarre looking creature. And everybody thought, if you look at it from our perspective, it does this display and you think, well, what it does is it clears a little dancing stage. It always has a twig in the middle, a little sapling in the middle. And it gets rid of all the leaves, strips the sapling of leaves, and then does this little dance. And the female, if the female likes it, it mates. We thought, well, okay. What we didn't realize is, why does the female always stand on that branch? Why does he always have a branch, this twig? Mm. And what happens is she'll only mate with him if she looks down on him. So you have to put the camera in that position. Then suddenly when you see that, you realize at the peak of the dance, he flicks open this enormous green ruff. And that's what is the thing that signs the deal.
And a lot of the stories you tell involve mating or animals wanting to mate. But not just animals. You captured bioluminescent fungi on the coconut forest in Brazil for the first time. It was impossible to even know when to shoot them in the past?
Well, that things like, when you do a series like Planet Earth, I think one of the joys of it is occasionally doing these utterly bizarre things, things that are almost out of this world, alien-esque creatures or living forms. And those fungi, the way when they produce their fruiting bodies and spores, it's just like something out of Avatar. And the reason why it was tricky in the past is the amount of luminescence is quite low, as you can imagine. So the sensitivity of the cameras wasn't really good enough to show it properly. But now we've got cameras that are sensitive enough, and now you can do it.
Because digital has changed everything?
We've been doing digital now for probably, 8 to 9 years. I think this series is shot in 4K, ultra high definition, and the sensors on those cameras, not only are they have higher resolution, they're just much more sensitive.
And you can see Planet Earth 2 tomorrow night at 9 on one of three networks. It's being simulcast across Sundance TV, AMC, and BBC America. My great thanks to Mike Gunton, who's executive producer of the series and also creative director at the BBC, for coming by to talk about it. It's really just such stunning television, really exciting.
Well, thank you very much. I've had a great time talking to you. Thanks a lot.